Hey, welcome to Short Fine Legs, the cricket podcast that stands up to a life in lockdown. In a similar way that Daryl Cunnellan stood up to Shane Warne, with a sense of impending dread of inevitable heartbreak, but still with an iota of hope that this might end well. Too bleak? Well, to cheer you up, this week I'm in conversation with a man who spins a yarn to rival the Bayeux tapestry, a man whose bulletproof truth shines a light in the dark corners of our world. One of South Africa's top cricket writers, Telford Vyse. Today we've partnered with two organizations, Raider Media, a podcast hub that produces some excellent shows to get you through these weird times, and SA Cricket Magazine, the leading publication in the country of this weird game. But enough of that, let's jump straight into it. So today I'm joined by a South Africa correspondent for CricBuzz, formerly with The Times, a man who hates cars but loves bicycles, a veteran journalist who sharpens his pencils in the press box with something that resembles a medieval siege weapon, an author and blogger who runs the site Bulletproof Truth with a mission statement of finding out why the lying bastards are lying, a good friend of mine and mentor who still does not follow me back on Twitter. It's a great pleasure to have you on the show, Mr. Telford Vyse.
Hello, Daniel. I don't follow anybody I like on Twitter. That's the way I do it.
Yeah, I'm sure the people that you do follow will be sad to find out that you don't like them.
Well, I wouldn't say I don't like them, but, you know, it's my mad reasoning. I've been watching a lot of French cinema lately, so I've gone a bit mad.
Yeah, fair enough. Madder than you have been. Well, listen, how's lockdown treating you, apart from watching a lot of French cinema?
It's okay. It has its ups and downs. I did 10K in my driveway the other day, and when I looked down at the driveway today, I thought, nah, I can't do that again. So there's... But yeah, you find out all sorts of things. Bob Dylan has released a 17-minute song. It's about the assassination of JFK. It's called Murder Most Foul. I haven't listened to it yet, but, you know, stuff like that, which maybe Bob Dylan wouldn't have had 17 minutes to make a song, but I'm going to go and find that out once I'm done here. So things like that, you know, you disappear down rabbit holes, which maybe you would have missed in the past. So there's ups and downs, but yeah, it's just awful to be stuck, but happily, people like you and I have places to be stuck in. You know, there are lots of people out there who do not have places to shelter in place in, as the Americans say. So we have it a lot better than some people.
Of course, no, that's absolutely true. And so, I mean, let's just get straight into it. So most journalists have as their pinned tweet an article that they're particularly proud of or a book that they've published. But yours is a picture of your red bicycle with the claim that it saves your life every day. So I've got two questions for you. How are you coping in lockdown with a particular focus on the lack of bicycle riding? And also, what's the story behind how it saves your life?
Well, the lockdown angle has two wheels to it, if you like. The first wheel is, God, the roads are so much more nice with no cars on them. It's fantastic. You can actually ride like a human being on the road. And you can ride because you can ride up to the shops here in South Africa to go and buy food. You can still do that kind of thing. In other countries, you can ride for exercise, I suppose, but I've never ridden for exercise. And the thing with the bicycle is that it just gives you such a better interaction with the world. When you're in a car, you're in your own little metal prison. You know, along with everybody else, you are the traffic. You're not stuck in traffic, you idiot. You are the traffic. On a bicycle, you have a much more real connection with the world. It's similar to walking, of course. It is more efficient than walking, and it's just changed my view on so many things. I just feel so much more part of the real world on a bicycle. It's much more efficient than driving a car. For anything up to, I'd say, 10 kilometers, you can get there quicker on a bicycle. It's much more enjoyable. It's the future. It's as simple as that. I love bicycles.
Yeah. No. So, and professionally now, how has the lockdown affect you? The lack of on-field cricket, you know, as a correspondent for a website, you know, as a freelancer for myself, I've tended to focus more on features and sort of the game away from the game. But obviously as a correspondent, you have to focus a lot of your work on the game. You're unable to do that. Have you enjoyed taking a bit of a step away from the field? And I'm looking at your recent articles, the one on Gower and Goliath, the virus uncertainty around De Villiers, stuff on Boucher and Dane Patterson. Have you enjoyed the work away from the game itself?
I have actually, because for me, the way I look at cricket writing, if I was to think of it as a painter, the cricket is always the frame, and it's not the picture, and that is the way I look at it. So it's actually been quite good that way in terms of, you know, you don't have to write about another bloody game, and the stats stand still and things like that. So it's been quite helpful in that regard. Yeah, you know, you can only write the story of there is no cricket in so many different ways, and then you've got to find other ways to make it fresh. And at CricBuzz, we're kind of delving into a few kind of series, you know, people who've not played much in the IPL, for instance, and sort of bit part players. I did a piece on Tyrone Henderson on that the other week. And then there's another series that's brewing on you know, guys who, how did they move into retirement, things like that. So it is obviously, it's a lot of it is quite sort of past focused, which it has to be. We've got to watch out for that, though, because I'm hating these things of, what are your five best games? You know, no. Where were you when this happened in cricket? And I don't like nostalgia. I think nostalgia is a dangerous thing. And there's a lot of that coming out. But yeah, there are things. You've got to look at what is cricket going to look like after all this? You know, dare we listen to administrators who have, most of them, not all of them, most of them have made lives and careers out of talking crap. Yeah, about how cricket should be, and this will be good for the game, and no. And it's not. There was a wonderful piece by Jeff Lemon on The Guardian the other day about, you know, what are we going to do? What is cricket going to look like? Or all sport, actually. Is it just going to be, maybe it's just going to have to start all over again, and it's going to be, you know, parents and their kids going off to the park, or just kids on their own, to go and play a game. Maybe it should just be like that, and not all of this big overhead money thing. So I think there's a lot to think about going forward.
For this episode, I thought we'd do something a little different, and we'll let the listeners dictate how the conversation takes shape, and we'll embellish as we go. But we'll start with some questions from some of our listeners and our fans. To kick things off, we'll address this burning question, and this one comes from Yandre Hubert, one of SA Cricket Magazine's own, who wants to know, what do you make of me copying your look with the hats?
Well, the real answer to that is, why the hell isn't everybody wearing a hat? It really is as simple as that. It's not a case of copying. I don't know how many people know, sitting in the press box at Centurion, you can get sunburned. Never mind there's a great big roof over your head. You know, the light just bounces off whatever it does, and you can absolutely get sunburned. That started at Lord's, in fact, in 2012, and I never used to do this. And the sun came blixtming through the window, and this massive bloody airport window at the Lord's, in the Lord's press box. And I knew I was going to die, so I had to go off to the shop and spend way too much money on a Panama hat. But that thing saved my life, and it kind of went from there. And now I'm counting them: 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, including the one on my head. Is how many hats there are. So, you know, and they're fun things. Why wouldn't you do it? So Daniel, I regard you as a man of very good taste and sensibility, is, I suppose, the real answer to that.
I once heard you in a conversation with someone, I think it was Khalid, who was interviewing for his Cricket Fanatics. Shout out to Cricket Fanatics. Great publication I think people should check out. And you said that you got into journalism because there was something quite romantic about it, that you considered journalists sort of cowboys, that, you know, how journalists can go out into the wild and come back with a story, and there was a bit of daring and adventure, you know, without having to go fight a war or actually live on the prairie. And I kind of feel that too, and I think wearing a hat in the press box and wearing a hat in, you know, when I'm covering a story or I'm interviewing someone, there's something a bit of a cowboy around it. It kind of adds to the mystique in a way. Do you feel that?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, you know, I'd be lying if I didn't say I do want to stick out a bit. I mean, you know, that's just ridiculous. Nobody becomes a journalist. Nobody puts their name in the paper or on the internet just about every day and doesn't have an ego to go with it. That's just a lie. So, yeah, that is quite fun. My favorite hat moment is I walked into the MCG press box on the day of the final of the 2015 World Cup, and Sami Al Hussein, who was then still with the ICC media manager, as I walked in, black hat and all, said, "All rise, Telford Vice is here," which I really, really enjoyed as a moment. So yeah, it's fun. The hats are fun, and they're very functional things, so they're good to have around.
Yeah, well, you heard it here from Telfuwas. Go buy yourself a hat. Just on hats and standing out. I mean, how has the energy of the press box changed since you started working in it in the early 90s? I mean, obviously it's changed quite racially, I imagine. But I wonder if there are more or even less women than there were before. What's sort of been the standout thing as the energy and the culture has shifted over the years?
There's certainly more women now. And thank goodness for that, because, you know, for a long time, and it still is in a lot of ways, it's a little bubble of misogyny, it can be, and it's terrible for that, it's not good. But what has, for me, changed the press box immensely and unrecognizably is, like, what's changed everything else is the arrival of the internet. I'm going to sound like a very old man now, but when I arrived in journalism, the first thing you did, you went to go and find the Telkom Tiffy in South Africa. Because he would be the man, and he was always a man, who had the phone lines, and you had to go and, you know, get your phone line. And if your name wasn't on the list of the Telkom Tiffy's list, there was no way you were getting a phone line, and I mean right. A landline, and it would be assigned to your seat where you were. And this was the thing that was there: Wi-Fi. What the hell was Wi-Fi? You know, so that has changed everything. Also, the internet has improved matters. Amazingly, because there used to be so many inaccuracies in the old days of reporting in the 90s. You know, if somebody missed something and asked their mate what happened there, you had to accept what that version was. There was, you know, there were hardly ever televisions in press boxes in those days, so there was no replay, and you'd get like ridiculous errors. I don't know how long Kepler Wessel's first name was spelled with two P's in reports back in the day, you know, things like that. So cricket writing, I think, now is vastly improved. It used to be this bunch of old men, mostly old men actually, who would sit around and pontificate, and nobody could ever argue with them because nobody could find the stat that would challenge what they were saying. Whereas now, you know, the way I write about cricket now is so different from how I did it in the 90s, because you would have the same thoughts. It's like, how many times has AB de Villiers done that? And there was just no way you could find out. You know, because there was no online stats resource, and not all of us knew Bill Frindle, the TMS legendary statistician. So, you know, you were kind of stuck, and you had to find other ways around it. So I think now cricket writing has become so much more creative. I think television has taken over a lot of the boring drudgery of actually analysing the actual game, what's going on the field. And I think cricket writers have been unleashed by the internet. It's a much better, much more fun job now than it ever used to be.
Does the departure from the mundane reporting, as you say, I mean, when you started writing cricket, people would read the newspaper to find out what happened. Whereas now there's highlights on YouTube and Instagram and so much analysis that you don't necessarily need to read what happened. People read to hear, you know, the whimsical. I mean, the reason why I read writing and why I like your writing is because of the whimsy involved and the narratives and the obscure little cultural references that help kind of piece the narrative together. But you say it's unleashed cricket writing, but has it made it more difficult to be a journalist? Has it made it more difficult to be good? Does that mean that journalists today can't just rely on being reporters or does that mean that it's opened up it's opened its space for people who might not necessarily be good reporters but are good literary writers?
Yeah, I think it's done probably all of that. It's probably chained a lot of people to desks, you know, where they've got to, their job is to go and find 10 stories and rewrite them, you know. And I'm afraid that's probably happening to younger people coming into the journalism industry in all fields of the journal, whether they're writing about cricket or politics or anything else. I think that happens, and that's unfortunate, because I think we're going to kill a lot of young creativity that way, and that's not nice. You know, there are always, of course, drudgery kind of jobs in any industry, but, you know, that's a major downside of it, is that how much, you know, young creative spirit are we killing by telling people that's your job, go and find 10 stories other people have written and rewrite them for this site now, today. And you know, that kind of thing is not like a... But it's also, you know, everyone can now be a writer. Everyone can publish. And that is a wonderful thing. As with everything, there's a lot of nonsense out there. There's a lot of just just stuff like, why? I want my 10 minutes back. I spent reading these bloody 3,000 words. There's a lot of that. But there's so much more avenue now. There's so many more avenues to find the good stuff. It's you know, you don't have to beat down a publisher's door anymore. You don't have to demand a job or keep applying for the same job. All of those things, that's gone. But in some ways, the internet can seem like a giant publisher's slush pile. And how the hell are you ever going to find something which is worth reading and worth knowing about? That's, you know, it's two sides of the same coin. Nothing is ever perfectly wonderful, and a few things are perfectly terrible. So I think that's where we are. I know that's a very long-winded and confusing answer, but I think, as you were saying, you know, the facts of any cricket matter, particularly current ones, are there. You can find them on the internet. You can find the live scoring. It's all over the television. But it challenges writers to go beyond that, much beyond that. And I've always looked at it that way. It's like, what can I tell you that you can't see for yourself? And if you're not doing that, then I don't think you're doing it properly.
No, I agree. As you say, and now anyone can publish. I mean, you, apart from, you know, the paid work, you put all that work on a blog called Bulletproof Truth. I'm curious. I've always been curious about the name of that. Is that a line from somewhere, or is that just something that you've come up with?
I don't think it's a line from somewhere. If it is, I've forgotten where it's from. I know that I'm quite guilty of writing that in emails sometimes, or quite a lot. When people say, how are you? I'll say bulletproof, thank you. and we go from there. But yeah, if it is a line from somewhere, I'm not sure where it's from. But the tagline is from somewhere, and I'm trying to furiously remember who it is. The tagline is, committed to finding out why the lying bastards are lying. Oh, no, I've updated it, haven't I, Daniel? What does it say now?
Damn. Okay, well, let's pretend that it hasn't, because my question is about that line. Committed to finding out why the lying bastards are lying. Why cricket then? I mean, I know cricket is merely a vehicle that you use to tell a story about politics and class and interchanging social dynamics, and you know, I'm the same. I don't know if it is for you. For me, you know, I turned my hand at a Newframe piece the other day that had nothing to do with sports, and I felt a bit naked in a way. I felt a bit unprotected by the vehicle of sport. You know, I feel so much more comfortable talking about things like race or class or economics or health if I've got sport as kind of, not a crutch, but, you know, sort of as a leaning post. Why not news and politics? Why sport? Why lean on cricket? Have you ever considered being the hard-nosed political journalist?
Well, why sport was essentially that's what the vacancy was. Many years ago, I'm from East London, South Africa, where there still is, as far as I know, just the one newspaper. I didn't have the money or the brains to go to university, so the way in was to keep applying to the Daily Dispatch in East London and just keep applying. And I did this from my second last year at high school. Every 3 months, I would send in an application form. And I just kept doing that. And eventually, after a few years, actually, I finally got a reply saying, we have a vacancy for a cricket writer. Do you want to come in and interview for that? And that is really the thing. So it could have been anything. I just knew I had to write about stuff. And that was the vacancy, was cricket. And here we are. That was 1991, and here we are all these years later. So that's essentially it.
But if that was all those years ago, have you ever considered shifting? I mean, like you say, finding out why the lying bastards are lying. We want to know why Thabang Maroro is lying, or why someone at the ICC is lying. But have you ever wanted to find out why, you know, sort of state politicians were lying, or why shady CEOs were lying without the, I don't want to use the word crutch, without the vehicle of sport?
Not really, because the what I found in cricket was that you could actually write about it. You didn't just simply have to report on it. You had to do that as well. Especially in the beginning of when I started doing this, but you could actually write about it. There was space to write, whereas with politics and just about everything else I could think of in journalism then in the 90s, there wasn't, especially for a junior reporter, there wasn't much space to write. You didn't get much room to write as opposed to report. You know, and in cricket, that was different. In my first week and a half on the job, Clive Lloyd came to town, and as part of one of Ali Wacker's development things, and I got sent off to spend the day with Clive Lloyd, and I was able to write a feature on that, which ended up on page three. You know, which was unheard of for a sports story. So I discovered very early that cricket you could actually write about, and I think that's what's more than anything has kept me with it. There's a cast of characters, and there are stereotypes and cliches that you can sort of revisit and bend and do stuff with. And then every few years the cast changes, you know, and there's this new oak. Have you heard of him? What's his name? Kagiso Rabada. Okay, let's see what he's like. You know, so there's a wonderful frame there to work with, and it kind of chucks in new characters and new things, and then suddenly there is a reverse sweep, and suddenly there's an IPL. So it stays the same, but it changes. So it's a great canvas to just keep in front of you, because it does change all the time. So it's wonderful from that perspective. Yes, I know like politics will change, but when I was establishing myself as a journalist, if I can be so grand, that was what I had to work with. You know, the politics of the time weren't really open to me. I was hired as the cricket writer, so I got on with that. And kind of when you look again, it's like, okay, well, here I am. You know, I've done a bit of this. It's quite fun. I might as well keep doing it. But you know, I have kind of used it to move just briefly into other things, or to kind of dabble. I did for Newframe, I did a piece on the Extinction Rebellion protest, for instance. That was last year, and I've done a fair bit for them on other kind of newsy bits. I'm working on a piece for them actually on the coronavirus lockdown situation. So, you know, I have used it to move briefly into other areas, but it's a good place to come back to. You know, I don't have any major passion for cricket itself, but it's a wonderful game to write about. I do have a passion for writing about cricket, and that's a very different thing.
And what I find, and you know, because people ask me the same question. I mean, obviously, I'm not as established to steal your word, but I find that with sports, if you talk about class and race without the context of sport, I mean, look, echo chambers exist in all spheres of writing. But I feel like if you don't use sport as that vehicle, you might be talking to the same people all the time. Whereas with sport, you know. Racists like sport, right? Bigots like sport. You can kind of infiltrate a conversation in a way that you might not necessarily do if the headline was just about xenophobia or just about evictions or whatever the case is. But if you use sport, you can kind of it allows you to permeate you know, kind of conversation groups that you wouldn't necessarily find yourself in. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. It blurs the white lines, which is a strange idea considering that there's so many white lines in sport, but it does. It kind of takes those lines away. You know, I feel a cliche coming on. You go beyond the boundary.
Let's get back to listener questions. This one comes from Tim DeLille, aka Tim the Cricket Guy, who was with us over the summer in Newlands. He says, "I know it's been a while since Telford last wrote his first and only book, In the Nick of Time, about the life and times of Peter Kirsten. But surely," Tim says, "this lockdown has provided the perfect opportunity for another one."
Another cricket book? Why? There's too many in the world already. There really are. There are a couple of book ideas floating about. You know, the book publishing game, if you like, particularly in South Africa, is stuck in the rut of player biographies. And I'm really not sure how keen I am to do one of those again. I did Peter Kirsten's way back when, I think published in 96, basically to find out if I could. That was the mission. I mean, I made enough money out of it to buy a dining room suite. So,
That's nice.
yeah, it was quite a nice dining room suite. So and really, that's all that players are really interested in talking about is their own biography. And then, of course, they want to meddle in there and make sure that you don't write any stuff which makes them look anything but heroic. So there's that. That's a problem. Publishers are generally only interested in that kind of thing as well. And then you get a couple of outliers. People like Luke Alfred comes up with interesting ideas every now and again and flies off on his tangent. But it would have to be a pretty sustainable idea. And in the South African context, and I don't want to write a book about what's happening in other countries, for instance. I think that's almost foolish. fraudulent. It's probably a harsh word for it, but I want to be in the moment of what I'm writing about and in the place of what I'm writing about, if I can. And so, you know, finding a subject cricket-related which you can sustain for book length. I mean, somebody, after the bonus scandal, the whole Gerald Majola thing, a publisher actually approached me and said, do you want to write a, write a book? You've been reporting about this like mad. Write a book. And I thought, you know, it was so difficult getting information out of sources like CSA about that whole thing, because CSA were kind of determined to commit suicide in the throes of all that. And I thought, what I know about this, I've written already. It's all out there, especially in Business Day. And I'm really not going to be able to add much to it. So, and that's honestly, you know, what I want to write about cricket is what I do right now. I'm not sure what I want to go into it any more deeply than I do now. And I'm not sure I want to put in the time and effort to find out much more about cricket than what I do now. So I might write a couple of more books, but whether they will be on cricket or not, they're unlikely to be on cricket, put it that way.
Talk to me about the writing process, because it's interesting you say that there are enough cricket books in the world, because I myself, without going into too much detail, I'm planning on getting another one out there, so I trust that you'll be reading at least that one. But I mean, it's something all writers think about, right? What advice would you give? What is the thing to remain conscious of throughout the process? I mean, you know, speaking to anyone who has written a book, it just seems like a pain in the arse. I mean, is it all worth it?
With that Kirsten book, I went through 7 stages of grief, maybe, or whatever, 12-step program I was in the midst of. It was like, it took me an age to get the first chapter out, because, you know, as a newspaper journalist, but only a newspaper journalist in those days, it's a case of, I need to tell the story in the fewest number of words possible. And whereas with a book, it's completely the opposite. You need to explode everything, you know, and make it as big as you can get it, or as long or as in-depth as you can get it. So that kind of changing the mindset from newspaper reporter to, right, I've got 400 words, to, right, I've got 40,000 words for the first few chapters was a nightmare. I was really stuck in this doldrum for weeks trying to sort this out. But once I got going, then I got going. And it was back in those pre-internet days. It was a strange process, actually. I would meet with Peter in the mornings, and we'd talk for like an hour. This would be recorded on my tape recorder. Then I'd go back and research what he said, which was a process in itself, because there's no internet. So what I did was I found a man called Trevor Beeling in East London who had this massive collection of cricket books, and I just borrowed everything from him that I thought could be relevant. So, you know, I lived in this room with Wisden's and Proteuranuals and so-and-so's biography and whatnot. And then I would go and research what Kersey said. And of course, I mean, you know, he's played an awful lot of cricket and he couldn't remember things accurately quite a lot of the time. And then I would go back to him and say, Kersey, you said you scored 26 there, but in fact you scored 56 and it wasn't 70 balls and da-da-da. And that would inevitably spark other memories. And the story would get bigger from that, because, oh, yeah, I remember that oak now, you know. And so we'd then go back and then I'd go and write it. And I did most of the research and the talking to Kersey took a good few months. And then I took leave from work for a month. And I basically wrote the book in a month. And I had this big plan on my wall, and the goal was 3,000 words a day. And that's more or less how I did it. You know, the room in which I was writing this book was kind of, there was a window onto the veranda, and Kersey would pop up every couple of days or so with a handful of jelly beans and kind of chuck them through the window for sustenance, things like that. So, and the last kind of couple of days of doing this was, I then wrote the thing, took it off to Kersey. How did I send it? It was probably on a floppy disk or a stiffy disk or whatever. And then took it off to Kersey's house at the other end of town, and he popped it into his computer, slept next to his dot matrix printer that night as page after page was like screeing out of the thing. And then flew off to, you know, Joburg the next day with the manuscript. And that was it. And he was actually a great help. He sourced all the photographs. We started that thing. It was agreed. I went to, in the days when reporters would go to net practices, some of them still do it, but I haven't been to one for hours. I mean, you know, we've both been in net practices, but I would go there to board a net practices, Nochal, and spend hours there. And that's how this came about. He was like strapping on a pad and looked up at me and said, Dels, you want to write a book? Okay. What book? My book. Okay. Yeah, let's do it.
And while he was betting?
He was strapping on a pad. Yeah.
He was strapping on a pad.
So basically, you know, at Nets. And there was a handshake. I'm not even sure there was a handshake, but there was never a contract. And it started out as a 50-50 arrangement in terms of money. And as it went along, I think it ended up at kind of 65-45 in my favor, because you could see that this was quite a lot of hard work. So, yeah, that was the, and I mean, the world is different now. You know, it's, you know, I wouldn't have to spend a year in a room full of books, for instance. So that was the process of that. It was just hard work. It was, and then, you know, once I'd written the thing, I was immensely proud. I thought, sheesh, look at that. But then I kind of would go back to it and look at that passage and think, that's terrible. I hate that. And I must have gone through a month or two of completely hating the bloody thing. And then, you know, eventually he said, nah, you know, let me look at that again. Yeah, that's not too bad. So it's a nice thing to have done. I ended up losing my copy of the thing, the one copy I had. And happily, Tristan Holm, a cricket writing colleague of ours, in fact, our features editor at CricBuzz,
yeah,
was checking out some books. And one of them was mine. He said, do you want it? I said, yeah, that'll do. Thank you very much. So I've got mine back now. I was heartened by his book chuck out because another one of it was the books he was getting rid of was the sports writing of Gay Talese, who's a wonderful, wonderful writer. He wrote brilliant stories about Joe DiMaggio and Frank Sinatra. And he was also getting chucked out. So I thought, hey, if I'm getting chucked out with Gay Talese, I can do that.
Yeah, good company there. Let's talk about that. I mean, the fact that you could be at a net practice, a proto cricketer could just say, hey man, do you want to write my book? No handshake needed, and you just get on with it. I can't imagine that happening today. I mean, to get an interview with someone today, you need to go through so many gatekeepers. To gain an exclusive or build the trust with players, you kind of have to know what their agent's name is, and you gotta be sweet with the media liaison, et cetera, et cetera. It seems like you really got to jump through a whole lot of hoops now. I mean, is that what do you make of the gatekeeping that exists in modern sports today? And how would you compare it to when you first started out?
I'm completely mistrustful of all media managers. I look at them from the gutter and I go, what story is this person trying to keep out of the media? That's just my default setting. And then, you know, it goes up from there. Some of them are better than others, as with everyone. But I don't trust media managers. I think they are there to get in the way of the story being published. Some of them do, as I said, prove otherwise. Some of them don't. But in my day, there was no such thing as a media manager. And in fact, I'll tell you a story from my first tour in 1992 to the West Indies, straight after the World Cup. And off we went for 3 1 days in a test match. And of course, Andrew Hudson scored a wonderful 100 in the test match at Barbados. But myself and a fellow from the Daily Telegraph, Jeffrey Dean, we missed Andrew Hudson's presser, which was one of three press conferences given on that entire tour, if I've got my facts straight. And that's a whole other story about how...
Well, if we get three in a day, we consider that an easy day out.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, we miss Hudders' presser, and it's like, because we were filing and whatnot, so we, oh God, now what? So I thought, well, I said to Jeffrey Dean, you know, Alan Jourdain, who's the team manager on that tour, he's seen my face once or twice, so let's try our luck. What we did was, we walked up to the dressing room door. I knocked on the door. Alan Jourdain, who's in the is a Dutchman. Alan Jourdain opens the door.
Yeah.
Yuri, sorry, man, but, you know, me and Jeff here, we missed Hudders' press conference. You know, do you think we might be able to just grab a word with him? Doesn't say anything to us. Looks to his right and goes, Hudders, it's Dux here. I want to talk to you. Do you want to talk to them? And Hudders comes hobbling, actually, to the door because he'd been hit behind the pad, behind the front pad, kind of on the side of his knee by Patrick Patterson. So he's like hobbling. And he looks up and he sees, He says, I'll talk to, I know this guy, I'll talk to these dogs. And he stands out there, he's like hobbling on the stairs in front of the dressing room and talks to me and Jeffrey Dean for like 20 minutes.
You know, and it's like flipping heck. If you had to try that today, you'd probably get shot or arrested before you got anywhere near the dressing room door. And then you'd have your accreditation taken away, and then you'd get fired. So it's changed an awful lot in that regard, you know. But the internet has made it so much better now in a lot of ways. But yeah, in that kind of way, in relationships with players, my test for this situation was always, does the player know the price of a pair of batting gloves? You know, I mean, it's gone way beyond that now. You know, the IPL has just removed players from the real world in terms of money, and their own lived experience has removed them so much that they're never coming back. You know, they're not quite footballers or Formula One drivers or tennis players, but they're just they're not real anymore. You know, they used to be real when I started. You actually could bump into a player in the pub. That was fairly common. But, I mean, you know, that's hardly going to happen now.
That's why we jump all over the story when Peter Malan gave that memorable press conference in Newlands, where he was like, "This, you know, a struggle is playing to nobody in a semi-professional game in the middle of nowhere. Playing against Jimmy Anderson at Newlands in a packed crowd, that it felt like a video game." I mean, that's why we get so romantic about that. But before we move on to that, Rex Clementine, the Sri Lankan cricket writer and just all-around good guy, wants to know a little more about that first tour to the West Indies. And I thought we could narrow down on an anecdote where you almost died. Would you mind sharing that?
A lot of people almost died. It wasn't just me. So it was the day that we were going from Jamaica, where the first ODI was played, to Trinidad, where the next two ODIs would be played. So this is the days of paper tickets. It's 1992. You know, there's no online check-in or anything. There's no online. So we have our paper tickets. It's myself, Rob Howing, and Sean Johnson, Nochal, who sadly died not that long ago, but then was political editor of The Star. And we're all standing in the queue to get onto the aeroplane and whatnot, and with our paper tickets. And we think, what the hell, we'll just, you know, cruise at the back here. Both teams are getting on the same flight. Ali Bacher and the rest of the suits are there. Let them all get through and whatnot. And so we'll just hang about here, talk among ourselves quietly. So we finally get to the front, and we present our tickets. And we get told, I'm sorry. And this is the worst Jamaican accent you'll ever hear. De plane.
You're still going to do it, are you?
Yeah. De plane, she full. Come back tomorrow. And we go, no, this can't be right. I mean, here's our tickets. No, de plane, she full. Come back tomorrow. Not a flight tomorrow. You'll get done then. And we go, but, you know, we have a job to do, what, all the rest of it. So Sean Johnson, who's far cleverer than certainly myself and perhaps cleverer than Rob Howing, says, you guys, just sort yourselves out as far as you can. I'm going to get Ali. Ali's already on the plane. How the hell is Sean Johnson going to get him? But anyway. So Rob Howing and I, we start sorting ourselves out. And we kind of gab our way through to immigration. And I've still got all my luggage with me and everything else. And the immigration guy says, immigration form, please. Now, bearing in mind, this is the first time I've been out the country. And I've been on a plane before, but I've never had to fill in an immigration form before, which, of course, we had to do just as we got into Jamaica. And I can't remember what I've done with this bit of paper, and I didn't have to hand it in, and it's now gone. But I start, you know, I'm in a bit of a mild panic now. I turn my suitcase upside down. I turn my work bag upside down on the floor of Norman Manley Airport in Kingston, Jamaica. And this immigration man is looking down at me from his desk quite quizzically. And eventually, after like 5 minutes of this, I look up to him and go, and my clothes are now all over the bloody airport floor. And I go, I'm sorry, I don't have it, this immigration form. And he goes, oh, you don't got it. Here we go. Fill in another one, which he hands over. And I think, okay, why didn't I say that? Anyway, and while I'm standing there filling in this immigration form, this fellow comes with one of those heavy steel trolleys, which used to be on railway stations in South Africa. They must weigh kind of 60, 80 Ks. And this thing goes crunch over my laptop, which is now lying on the airport floor. It's a Tandy. You could only see 5 lines of print on these things anyway. It was kind of prototype laptop. Anyway, so now the screen is just about separated from the keyboard on this thing. And I'm thinking, why the hell do I want to get on this plane? I can't do much work now anyway. But the guy got fill in my immigration form. I pack up my stuff. And what do you know? I'm walking out to the plane. And I think, how the hell did this happen? And it was a Boeing 707. So you kind of climb up the back end of this thing. and they lift up the door behind you. And myself and Rob Howing and Sean Johnson were like the last three people on this plane. And I remember standing on the tarmac. How did he get onto the tarmac? My old friend Jeffrey Dean, who, you know, he and I interviewed, I was standing on the stairs at Barbados, so we would do in a couple of weeks. And he was demanding to get on the plane. But, of course, there were no more seats. And so, but somehow he talked himself onto the tarmac. Anyway, plane takes off. And Norman Manley Airport in Kingston, Jamaica, is on this kind of finger of land that juts out into the Caribbean. And the plane takes off, and it gets up a couple of hundred meters. And then there's this mad judder. And the plane starts veering towards the ocean. And I'm thinking, this is not good. And I don't know if it's a memory or an imagination, but I do have this picture in my mind of a wingtip catching the water.
Oh, my God.
And I thought, ah. But the guy, the plane kind of rights itself, and the pilot says, ladies and gentlemen, we have a problem. We'll be returning to Norman Manley Airport. And I thought, I bloody well hope so. And happily we did. And we sat around for about 4 hours while the players were playing cards, and we were on the plane to on the flight to Trinidad after that. We get to Trinidad. It's now obviously far later than we should have arrived. And they line us up, and the first thing they do is take our passports away. And I've now run out of sense of humor probably several hours ago. And I'm standing in this queue. My passport's been taken away. I'm having all sorts of thoughts about, you know, Midnight Express and all sorts of whatevers. And I start muttering, and I'm muttering and muttering, and the muttering is getting louder and louder and louder. This country, and there's a bit of swearing going on or whatnot. When I look again, Ali Bach is in front of my face, and I don't know if he thought I was drunk. I had a drink all day, and he looks up at me, and he's quite a lot shorter than I am, is Ali, and he's staring straight up at me, and he goes, "Are you all right, sir?" It's the first and only time Ali Bach has ever called me sir. But this carried on for a fair few minutes. Ali Bach asking me the same question, and I'm muttering a lot of, "Are you all right, sir?" And it's becoming a scene. And eventually I kind of fetch what little sanity I have left, and I go, "Yes," and I shut up. And eventually we get our passports back, and we're on the bus into Port of Spain, and we're staying at the Hilton. Everybody stayed at the same hotel. There's another difference in those days. Players, media, whatnot. And we get into the lobby. It's now early hours of the morning. I don't know, 3-4 o'clock in the morning. There's nobody around. But with us on this flight also is Tony Kozier, the West Indian broadcaster, and his son, Craig Kozier, who was then his statistician. There's no one. And there's just like phalanx of people arrive in the lobby. And I remember Craig Kozier's got the suitcases, and he puts them down. And all he says is, "Kozier is here." And I don't know from where. 50 people came leaping over the front desk because Tony Kozier is such a bloody celebrity. It's like, "Oh, Mr. Kozier, whoa, 4 o'clock in the morning." They more or less carried him and Craig up to their rooms, and the rest of us got in the lift. And I remember getting into the lift going, "God, this is quite some job." And that was all in one day. And after that, I was scared of nothing.
Yeah, it's such a weird job, isn't it? I mean, whenever I tell people what I do, and they are cricket fans, they swoon, and I don't mean that in an arrogant way, but it's a bloody dream to get paid, you know, admittedly not very much, to watch and write about cricket and get, you know, the way we're treated in the press box, like VIPs, you know, endless food and Wi-Fi and comfortable seats, and, you know, we're getting paid to be there. We don't pay to go watch it. But what would you say is the greatest misconception about our industry? What is the one thing that people think happens and doesn't really, or happens in a different way?
A lot of people seem to think we don't work much. Well, I think we just like sit around there and you know, and then at some point just type out a few paragraphs and go to the pub, you know. And it's really not like that. And that's another change from now. You know, back in the day, you would probably write one story per day, and that would be that. But now, of course, journalists are mostly working all day. You know, they're tweeting this and whatever that, and this video and that, that are, they're doing an awful lot. So I think people think we don't actually work, not that much anyway. You know, we'll go to these places and from the other side of the world or whatever cricket ground, and that we're having such a fat jaw, where in fact we're seeing, you know, airport, ground, and hotel. But you know, it is. We get free Wi-Fi, free food, wonderful seats,
you know, all of that kind of thing. It's you get so much free, and it really grates me when people start complaining about the Wi-Fi not working properly.
I won't mention names, but I remember we were in the over this last tour in England, when England were touring South Africa rather, and a very prominent English journalist took a sip of the coffee and almost spat it out and said, "Is this decaf?" And I thought, mate, why are you making such a scene? I just thought that really encapsulated what you were talking about. But obviously, it doesn't all go according to plan all the time, does it? I mean, you were one of the five journalists, infamously, who had their accreditation removed after some scathing articles and comments made about the ousted CSA chief executive, Thabang Moroa, and the way he handled, or rather the way he ran the organization. I mean, could you talk about the moment you discovered you were on the naughty list and what your immediate thoughts were?
I actually got a call from Newlands because there was an MSL game on that day.
It was your first day with CricBuzz, if I'm not mistaken.
It was the first day with CricBuzz. They must have thought, I wonder if this is a good idea. So we were preparing to go off and cover this thing at Newlands. And I got a call from Newlands to say, strange thing here. Stuart Hess has been locked out of the Wanderers in Joburg, and we've got this list of journos, five names, who we are not to allow in the ground, and you're among them. But what we're going to do here in Newlands, we're going to buy you tickets. They'll be at this gate. It was all very John le Carré. They'll be at this gate, and you need to pick them up and whatnot, and come in and do what you need to do. That's fine. So, quite honestly, the feeling was, here we go again, because I've had previous experience of this kind of thing with CSA, when the chief executive was Harry Logat, and the politics that flew around then, and basically CSA tried to get me fired for 3 years, as well as Fidoz Mundo, who's the Crick Info correspondent, and who's also my spouse, and they tried to get us fired for 3 years, and they tried all sorts of underhanded ways. They would offer my colleagues interviews they knew they would not grant me, for instance. We were never on any kind of notification list. We were off for so long that we got back, finally they let us back on, and we realized, oh, there's a CSA media WhatsApp group, fancy that, because this thing didn't exist. That was my, I think, response was, here we go again, I've been through this before. Do your worst. You can't scare me. You try to get me fired for 3 years. I'm still here. But then, of course, we went off to the game and ended up sitting in the stands to start with, which was novel. It wasn't too bad actually. It's a nicer atmosphere than in most press boxes. I can tell you that. It's a bit tricky when you're not sure when the oak next to you is going to pour his beer over your laptop. So it's
right.
Those kinds of situations. People in a box said, why don't you come and sit with us rather? It's more comfortable here. So we went off there. They had food and power. And by the end of the day, we were back in the press box. And Tami Mtembu, who is still CSA's head of media, was trying to explain in some very weird, odd, bizarre way why he hadn't been part of this and why this had happened or hadn't happened. And, and it was just this crazy, crazy episode. I've got the audio file somewhere because when he came to talk to me, I started recording. And the first 20 minutes of an hour-long recording is me shouting at him, basically.
That whole saga was so interesting. I mean, I was still in the UK. I mean, I'm in the UK now, but I hadn't yet come to South Africa to cover the summer's cricket. And it was interesting watching from afar. And the one thing that I noticed is that in South Africa, we put up with corruption and crime and inequality to the point that these are just words that are accepted byproducts of life in Mzansi, right? But a line was crossed with the apparent gagging of journalists, a constitutional line. And if there's one thing that is sacred in South Africa, it is the constitution that Mandela gave us. And freedom of speech and a free press are important pillars of that constitution. What did you make of the reaction, the way that you and the four other senior journos, were treated? I mean, do you think it says something about the way we love our constitution? Or am I painting a bullseye around an already shot arrow here?
I was amazed. I really didn't think it would have that kind of impact. And then we had the South African National Editors Forum, getting involved, and this person and that person and this organization. I thought,
Maybe we're more important than I thought we were. Because you know, it really felt that way. I honestly didn't expect that kind of reaction. I expected people to be kind of mildly disapproving, but I really didn't expect that. But perhaps it was a case of the straw that broke the camel's back, you know, and maybe people were looking for a reason to get rid of Thabang and Thabang Mure, the former chief, or the suspended chief executive. And maybe that was it. They could use that, because then he'd gone beyond pissing off sponsors, you know, or making sponsors walk away, which is something for his own board to get unhappy with him about. The thing had burst its banks when you're now meddling in press freedom. And maybe that was the straw, but it was heartening. You know, I haven't felt that important since the day I was thrown out of Zimbabwe for being a cricket writer. I didn't expect things to get that big. I honestly didn't. It was heartening to see. It was good that people took such an interest. And it did. It made me feel happy, I suppose, is the word for it.
All right, let's run through three quick questions from some listeners. Taito Msimango, I hope I'm pronouncing your name correctly, mate, is an aspiring journalist who wants to know what you think of the standard of journalism in South Africa and how it has changed over the last three decades. We're such an insecure nation, aren't we, that no matter what industry we're talking about, we're always comparing ourselves and craning our necks to see what other people are doing overseas. I mean, are we right up there in our cricket writing?
No, and I'm afraid, I don't think it's the cricket writer's fault or the reporter's fault. It's the fault of the media companies. I think our media companies are in a terrible way. I mean, you know, the independent group is a mess. You talk to anybody who works there and they're either depressed or terrified, one of the two. You know, the company I used to work for, what are they called now? Arena Holdings. It was a good place to work. I worked with good people, but there is uncertainty about the company and about its viability. So, and you know, and those kinds of things. But the reporters and the editors I worked with, I'd happily work with them again. But one of the reasons I left was because of the uncertainty, you know, in terms of money and economic terms. And I think that does change everything about, you know, the British newspapers, they're also struggling, but they're good because they're willing to put money into things like cricket writing. And that does change everything. Australian newspapers are the same way. And I'm talking about broadsheets here, not so much tabloids. I think South African media is hamstrung. I mean, the Mail and Guardian, you know, is really, really struggling as a newspaper, never mind just as an outlet for sports writing. I think that changes everything, and I think that you can't look past that. I think in some ways South African cricket writing has got better from when I started. You know, those old men who couldn't spell Kepler vessels, for instance. You know, that doesn't happen anymore, and we have more women now. But it's also, you know, I think there's a thing that's happened in other parts of the media, the juniorization. That does make you sound like an old man when you say that, but it is. It's like people being let loose on things, and then I see young reporters who because they've been plunged in, they haven't got the confidence to do things. I mean, there was an instance of, I won't mention the reporter's name, whose story, they filed their story, it was published, and they had such little confidence in it that they asked for it to be taken down from the website. You know, those kinds of things, and that's a product of juniorization of somebody, you know, being put into a job and basically being told they're not ready, and then they're told to go off and do it, you know, and things like that. There's bad things. But my advice, it's the same thing I do before I write every story. When I sit down, I go, why should anyone bother reading this? And I try and make it worth reading. I don't care what the players think of it or the administrators, because if you're doing that, then you've crossed a very big line, because your constituency, I'll get it out eventually, is always the reader. You know, you have to be on the side of the reader. What do they want to know? Why should they read this? And if you have an answer for that question, then you have the beginnings of a story. And right from your heart. Never mind, there's various theories about how to write stories. Apparently, one's called a pyramid, one's called a champagne glass. Bugger that, just write this.
Yeah, no, I agree. Just write something that you yourself would want to read, and that you think, and like I say, why would anyone else want to read it? I think if you just stick with those two things, you're on the good track. Asimakhle, oh God, I really hope I'm pronouncing that one right, asks, why did you fall in love with the game? I mean, you often give the impression that you don't always love it, and I think that's a good thing. I mean, the last thing you want from any critic is to be blindly in love with the subject they're writing on. But without taking a left turn into negative town, to steal a line from Faf du Plessis, what are your overall sentiments towards The Strange Game? I mean, let's focus solely on the positives, and what are they?
I have to say that I can't say I love cricket. I do love writing about it. I think because it does it I think it's kind of got writing built into it in a strange way, because you know, it demands to be written about, and the people who play it, I think they are diminishing as characters as we have more and more media managers and agents getting in the way of the story. So you don't often find out these days, you know, you can't spend a day with Joss Butler, you know, unless it's carefully managed, whereas that didn't used to be the case. But it's still, there's in some ways so little happens on the field that you've got to fill in the gaps in good ways. You know, it's not like football or rugby, and I've covered quite a lot of rugby, and I'd go home and watch the highlights because I've written all about this game, but I haven't a clue what happened. You know, and cricket isn't like that. Cricket follows a narrative. Even T20, there's a narrative there, which it's your job to stitch that together in a way that the reader hasn't, you know, may not have cottoned on to, and it's your job to make that alive in a different way. So I think cricket offers that. To a large extent, you can do that with cricket. It is very writable. That's what I like, the scope and the sweep. I like the various extremes. You know, in Test cricket, if you don't bowl them out, you don't win, and that's a wonderful thing. You know, nothing else really matters. And if you cannot win and you can draw, well, that becomes its drama on its own. T20 offers different extremes. You know, if you can't hit it further than those oaks, you're going to lose. Or if you don't have enough slow balls in your attack, or enough creativity in your attack, you're going to lose. I love that. ODI cricket, I'm like, I'm a bit over that. You know, it's the 30-year-old teenager that refuses to leave home. It's just like, what are we going to do with this bloody idiot? So I'm a bit out of love with ODI cricket. But, you know,
I agree.
Yeah, you know, but Test cricket, it's always on the edge. Even when it's not on the edge, there's an edge there somewhere.
There's something joyous in even in the mundane periods that when nothing happens. There's still, as you say, like the chance for something beautiful. I mean, a stout forward defense that has nothing is still dripping with meaning if you know what you're looking at.
And even if you can, you know what, the wonderful thing about Test cricket, you can invent your own meaning.
Yeah, well, exactly. I read a piece recently that it requires a degree of creativity to enjoy cricket, and it was kind of a piece about why lockdown, you know, if anything, why cricket has prepared us for a life in lockdown, because it conditions you to find some joy in the nothingness, that you can sit down and literally watch the lack of traffic outside your house and be like, there's a story here. There's something going on, even though it isn't always apparent. Just two final questions from some fans. Asim Makhle again wants to know, who are the three greatest players of all time? But I think let's narrow that down. Just quickly, who are the three greatest players you've seen live?
Yeah, that I've seen live. That is difficult. I was going to say Frank Worrell, but I never saw him. The three greatest players I've seen live. That is very, very difficult. Andrew Hudson is in there somewhere. He's just a ridiculous player. Just wonderful, fluid player. And because he was so human and also so fallible, could look very clumsy and just look a complete dream. Alan Donald was a fine, fine player. Loved watching him bowl. And it's I don't know, it's an odd thing. Dave Richardson. I have one memory of Dave Richardson as a cricketer. And it is on the last day of that Barbados test in 1992, the pitch had become horrendous. And I can't remember who the bowler was. And he played a four defensive to a delivery that basically went straight up after bouncing in front of his boot. And he ended up middling the ball with his bat above his head, playing a four defensive. It was the most outrageous thing. So it's you know, I probably don't think in terms of players. I think in terms of moments like that, rather than star players. But yeah, those two. Lara was wonderful to watch. You know, so, and if I can add a fourth, I think Ben Stokes, for all his light and shade, is the best thing that's happened to cricket since...
He's phenomenal, isn't he?
Probably since Lara, yeah.
It's funny you mentioned Lara and Stokes. I had those two and AB as my three. Oh, maybe Steyn ahead of AB, actually.
Well, Steyn's another one. I'm very biased with Del Steyn because he's actually a human being.
He's such a good guy, isn't he?
So it's just, well, some parts of him are...
Well, so yeah, sometimes, as you say, he's just a normal human being.
He's just a proper human being. So I mean, after that thing on Yanam, I wrote a piece on Yanama Milan and Peter Milan. And then I spoke to the other Milan, who nobody even knows about. And he turns out to be more human than all of them, you know.
And a good writer.
And a wonderful writer. So, you know, he's my favorite Milan. There's no doubt.
Just finally, this is from John Henry Wilson, who in a private message, I don't know if John Henry will appreciate this, but he says that you are his cricket writing hero. He wants to know who was the best border cricketer interviewee you had at the Daily Dispatch, and I'm going to throw in another one. Who is your best interview in general? So in general and at the Dispatch in particular.
At the Dispatch, probably the border coach Stephen Jones. Who was a wonderful left-handed all-rounder for Western Province back in the day and could play the piano and could tell a good story and smoked a great deal and is like holed up in England somewhere now. He's a very articulate man. He was a good oak. Kenny Watson wasn't bad either to talk to. He was a much more basic human being. He was a proper Eastern Kuiper was Kenny. And he was also a good oak. And then just what? All in all, best interview. Yeah. Del Steyn comes pretty close. He's always good to talk, and you don't get the feeling that there's a guard up with Del Steyn. Doesn't talk in cliches. That's the worst. People who sit there and say what they think you want them to say, you know, that's really terrible. And actually, Quinton de Kock.
Quinton was mine, actually.
Quinton de Kock. There's no varnish and there's no media management there, and you can almost see the media managers pulling their hair out, like, oh my god, what is he going to say now? You know, but there's a wonderful unguardedness about him. Somewhere in those.
Self advice. You have been very, very generous with your time, mate. I really appreciate it. You know, I'm a fan of your work, so I won't stay too long on that. Just to finally end, what is your hope that once cricket returns? I mean, if you could change, if there's something that you could change, I mean, whether you expect it to or not. I mean, I expect. Normality to resume pretty quickly, where we're arguing over finances and coal packs and is AB de Villiers going to play? Jesus, is that narrative ever going to end? What is the thing that you hope once we get back out there?
I want more respect for the fans from all aspects of cricket. I want stadiums to be better, and I want media coverage to take the readership and the viewership and the listenership into account more. And that means the SABC needs to put more cricket on, you know, television and radio. And it means people like CSA need to understand that and not make their product expensive. And you know, those kinds of things. That's honestly what I want is more respect, more being done for the people who actually go and watch the game and are interested in it and read about it and want to watch it. I think that's the most important thing. I think we've lost that. With the way that all sport has gone now. It's all about the players and the money and the what. It's not you idiots. It's about the people who actually watch the game that you put out there. And that's what I want to see happen in the future.
Top advice. Thanks very much, man.
Sure, fella.
That's our show. Thanks again to Raider Media for their production input on the show. Check them out on Twitter at Raider_Media. You're going to love their podcast there. Well, do check them out. Also, thanks to SA Cricket Magazine. You know where to find them. If you're listening to this, you're no doubt a reader, watcher, tweeter of their content. Go show them some love. And while you're at it, why don't you follow us on Twitter at @short_fine_legs. Don't forget the underscores. And me at Daniel Gallen. Please share, like, retweet, tell your mates, bombard your family. Help us grow the pod. All the love is appreciated. Listen, folks, stay safe. Look after each other. Be kind to each other. We're going to get through this together. Catch you next time.